A problem of considerable importance is that of using rail and road transport systems in such a manner that an optimum use is made of these assets and that their development is so designed that two together serve best the national interests. Towards this direction, attempts have been made, but not much headway has so far been made. To form a rational view, we should study as to why a coordination between the two is necessary and in which areas it can be effected and why success has not as yet attended our efforts. Complementary transport services. Being the two most important systems of surface transport, railways and road transport are complementary, particularly so in a vast and agricultural country like India. From within a village, motor transport collects agricultural produce in small quantities. These then are delivered after travelling short and medium distances at local medias or at railway stations. So is the case when villages have to be supplied with inputs and customer goods in small quantities and from short and medium distances. Railways on their own part take charge of big quantities and transport them over long distances. They also bring large amounts of inputs and consumer goods from far off places to be distributed by motor transport in small quantities and in the interiors of villages. In respect of towns, too, the same applies if the quantities involved are small and distances over which these have to move are short. Quantities and distances apart, there are other considerations which pinpoint their respective spheres. For example, motor transport can deliver goods at and collect from the doorsteps of consumers, which railways cannot do. Again, it can adjust its timetable to the convenience of customers, which railways cannot do. On the other hand, railways have fixed places for loading and unloading. Further, the working hours of personnel are so regulated and the timetable so fixed that not much flexibility is possible in its operations. It is also claimed that there being more of personal touch in road transport, the service is more adjustable to the needs of goods and passenger traffic and that there is less of pilferage than in the case of railways where personal touch is remote. Yet again, it is said that between loading and unloading at the point of destination, the time spent with motor transport is much less competitive. While in practice, rail and road systems should supplement each other, these have become competitive, thereby duplicating services and involving wastage of resources. In this battle for more business, road transport seems to have an edge. Its share in the expanding demand for transport has arisen at a faster rate than that of railways. This is evident from the fact that the share of mechanized road transport in passenger traffic, which was a mere 26% in 1950-51, has risen sharply to about 80% at present, that is 1994-95. In freight traffic too, there has been an increase, albeit slow, from 12% of the total freight traffic in 1950-51 to 60% at present. As against this, the share of railways has declined. Of course, in the absolute terms, the goods traffic handled increased to a greater extent for railways than for roads, but the more important fact is the sharing of increased traffic, a greater proportion of which was attracted by road transport. Absence of coordination. Considering the wasteful nature of the competition, attempts have been made from time to time to eliminate it, but not much success has been achieved. There are two main reasons for this. One is that in earlier stages and till very recently, these attempts were not so much at coordination as putting restrictions on or at best regulation of motor transport with a view to protecting railways. For example, during 1930s, when the competition became severe, the committees appointed in 1932 and 1937 in this connection and the Motor Vehicle Act 1939, which embodied most of their recommendations, sought the control of motor transport through such devices, compulsory licenses, observance of certain conditions in respect of maintenance of vehicles, speed regulations, permit system to prohibit free transport for goods, etc. Despite the fact that these committees did suggest measures for improvement in railway services such as shuttle train service for short distances, cheap season and return tickets, etc., the totality of steps taken in the name of coordination were, as pointed out by the Road Transport Committee of 1959, one-sided and amounted to restriction of the road transport. The second reason is the faulty approach towards the question of railway finances. On one hand, railways are asked to bear social responsibilities and incur huge expenditures such as on unremunerative lines or low earnings, such as by charging lower rates on certain goods like food grains, etc., and on the other, they are asked to balance their budgets from their own resources. This forces railways to function like a commercial enterprise and compete for every item of traffic and everywhere, whether or not these suit it. Correct approach. In the absence of any coordination, road transporters not only try to outbid railways over short distances but also get into long route traffic. This intensifies the rivalry with inevitable wastage for the society. It is therefore necessary to conceive a national transport policy in such a manner that makes a fuller use of both the modes of transport in their respective spheres and which at the same time leaves enough scope for both to develop faster than before. The fact that road transport is growing faster than railways is not peculiar to India. In European countries, the same has happened, and it is so because of the inherent superiority that this medium has over the railways in certain areas. Spheres. The important thing then to do is to ensure that no unnecessary restrictions are placed on the expansion of road transport, and the more important task is to regulate the growth of both the transport systems so that avoidable duplication does not occur and there is optimum utilization of social resources. Modern road transport. The road transport confers all those benefits mentioned above that any other means of moving men and material does. However, this mode of transport has special advantages of great significance for a country like India. We first mention them. We shall then discuss its present position, its progress, and the problems it faces and their solution. First one, special merits. Because of its peculiar characteristics, the road transport is very useful in such important matters as generation of employment, provision of relief to the very poor, promotion of rural development and meeting several needs of the society. Large employment potential. The single most important benefit is the large employment that it generates. It has been found that no other economic activity can probably match the quantum of employment which road construction, its maintenance and operation can create. Two studies may be cited to substantiate the point. The National Council of Applied Economic Research, in a study reported in 1960 that road industry in its broad sense, that is, road construction, their maintenance, provision and maintenance of vehicles, production of tires, etc., employed 24 lakh persons. Another estimate puts it at 60 lakhs. It has been estimated by NCAER, that is, the National Council of Applied Economic Research, that the job potential is so large that an investment of 1 crore of rupees would provide work to about 12,000 people, and when roads are opened for use, additional 4,100 jobs would be created for operation and servicing of road transport vehicles. A study of the Reserve Bank of India in 1970 estimated that employment is the highest in the cause of roads at 10,435 per investment of 1 crore rupees. Even the next high employment generating activities, that is forests, including soil conservation, at 8,000 is way behind the potential of roads. Estimates in respect of employment opportunities for various activities put roads at the top. It has been calculated that an amount of investment which would create 52 jobs in agriculture, 50 in housing, 17 jobs in small and large scale industry, or 19 jobs in railways would create 104 jobs in the road transport section. Relief to the destitute. Again, this service industry is considered the most suitable medium for the relief of the very poor. It is an economic activity wherein wages form a substantial part of the cost. Not only that, the more significant fact is that a very large proportion of wage bill goes into the hands of those who really need it. For example, the study of NCAER calculated that of the total wage bill, as much as 90% reaches persons drawing less than Rs. 150 of basic salary per month, and as little as 2% of the payments goes to persons drawing Rs. 500 and more. Again, this program can be had for the asking because it involves no long drawn out studies. Its execution is easy too, as it does not depend much upon skill, outside resources and foreign exchanges. The next point is rural development. Solution to mass poverty and massive unemployment through the development of agriculture, village and non-villages, small industries can be very much facilitated by roads and road transport. This mode of transport alone can reach the interiors of villages, into the fields and the workplaces. It can collect small amounts of agricultural produce from the overwhelmingly large number of small farmers. The products of small-scale rural and cottage industries, being small in each unit, can best be handled by this agency. Again, small number of passengers moving to and from at any one time and every time will find buses, etc., convenient means of mobility. Connecting towns with villages can perhaps be better done with road rather than through any other means of mode transport. In all these spheres, road transport has an advantage over railways. And precisely for these reasons, the share of road transport in expanding goods and passenger traffic is increasing fast. Meeting multiple needs. Apart from its benefits for the rural areas, it is very important for the people's life in general. It has, for example, certain advantages which make this mode of transport particularly suitable for many economic and social needs. It is very useful for short and medium distances. It is flexible in respect of timetable. It is reliable in respect of speed and door-to-door service. Such is it is. Significance that even other transport modes do function more effectively when linked to road. Road transport thus forms an indispensable element of the national transportation system.
Progress and problems. The Indian road network is one of the largest in the world. It has no doubt expanded in the last 4 decades or so, but the progress has rather been inadequate. At the same time, its service is far from satisfactory in several respects. The first problem is slow-paced growth. The length of roads, the basic requirement of this mode of transport, has grown at a slow rate, from about 4 lakh kilometer in 1950-51 to about 25 lakh kilometer in 1999-2000 is no doubt a rise by over 6 times, and by itself an impressive progress. But when considered in the context of countries, area and population, it is not so. In the comparison with some other countries, it is much less than what can be termed as even near adequate. Area-wise, the road length works out to be about 41.8 km for every 100 square kilometer. Of course, of this, the surface road, which is what really matters, comes to be as low as 18.9 km. Population-wise, a bare 293-kilometer road serves as many as 1 lakh population, with surface road even much below at 113.6 km. The gross inadequacy of India's road can be visualized if we juxtapose these figures with those of some other countries. In Sri Lanka, for example, which is no better place than us, there are 64.39 kilometers of all kinds of roads and 58.37 kilometers of surface roads per 100 square kilometer area. Also, per lakh population, if it has provision for 324.3 kilometers of all roads and 294 kilometers of surface roads. In another semi-industrialized country, Spain, the road length is such that there are 27.60 kilometers of surface road per 100 square kilometer areas, with no unsurfaced roads, and 404 kilometers per 1 lakh population. So the second problem is now uneven distribution, which is the subheading. Even the little that is there is unevenly distributed among different regions. This is to be seen first in the disparity between different states. For example, UP, with largest population and large land area, stands third in total length of roads as also in respect of surface roads. Again, another big and populous state, Bihar, is 10th as far the total road length is concerned, and it is 8th in respect to the surfaced roads. As against this, Karnataka holds first position in respect to total road length and is also at the top with its substantial share of surface roads. Similarly, Andhra Pradesh is 8th in respect to total road length, but at 7th position in sharing the surface road. West Bengal is 12th in the total road length, but way below at 16th in the share of surface roads. The inference is clear. The development of modern surface roads has been inequitable. The unevenness is the availability of roads is also to be found between cities and villages, with the latter literally. At least a large many among them, 54%, are without all weather connecting roads. This is all the more unfortunate because a major part of population lives in villages, and further agricultural operations, in particular marketing, require short distance roads in abundance to connect them with the main roads and railheads. Similarly, in hilly and tribal areas where population is sparse and railways are an impossible economic proposition, there is an acute deficiency of all weather roads. The next is poor quality. It is not in quantity alone that we are short. Quality of roads too is poor, and of unsurfaced roads poorer still. More than half being unsurfaced, our roads are not fit for efficient transport, particularly during the rainy season when even bullock carts cannot ply with ease. Also, a sizable part of the surface roads, particularly in the categories of district and block highways, is no better than water surfaces evolved some 150 to 200 years ago for horse and buggy transport. The pavement width of most of road length is single lane. Even in case of national highways, about one third of the length has single lane road paved. The road system as a whole suffers from serious deficiencies, and there is a growing mismatch between traffic needs and available infrastructure. This results in the underutilization of capacity, delays, congestion, fuel wastage, and higher vehicle operating costs. All this means wastage of national resources. For example, fuel wastage due to bad roads is estimated at rupees 500 crores a year. In addition, there are many times bigger losses on account of extra wear and tear of tires, spare parts, and other components. The next is small number of vehicles. Additionally, and caused partly by inadequate and low quality roads, the number of vehicles is very small. The total number of vehicles in all types, two-wheelers, three-wheelers, cars, jeeps, buses, trucks, etc., in India is about 409 lakhs in 1998. The number has no doubt expanded much by over 125 times since 1951, when the total was a mere 3 lakh, but it is still grossly inadequate. Compared to some other countries, mostly developing like US, the position is very unsatisfactory. As per comparison made a few years ago, vehicles per 100 km of roads and per 1000 population respectively for some countries including India, where Thailand 31:24, Indonesia 10:7, Pakistan 10:7, Sri Lanka 4:12, and India was at the lowest rung with 4 and 3. The gross inadequacy is highlighted if we recall that in Japan there are 27 vehicles per 100 km of road and 257 vehicles per 1000 population. The next problem is high cost transport. The roads are not only inadequate, but being of poor quality, caused transport costs to remain high. Were these roads to be of good quality, according to the Kasker Committee, 1967, the cost would have been halved as compared to that on bad roads. It is a simple law of transport economics that the cost of haulage per ton mile declines steeply with increase in the capacity of vehicles. As per one estimate, with increase in the gross weight of vehicles, the cost per ton mile in relation to a vehicle of 9 tons gross declines sharply as follows with weight of vehicles and cost given in this sequence: 13.5 tons 60%, 18 tons 43%, 22.5 tons 34%, 27 tons 28%, and 37 tons 23%. This happens because transport costs are very sensitive to speed, and good roads can stand heaviness of vehicles. Now, both these things are possible only on good roads. All in all, the road transport system of the country is both inadequate and insufficient. It is in the context of this deplorable state of affairs that the World Bank survey, in collaboration with the Planning Commission, remarked that the major lag in Indian transport development in roads were the effects of the revolution in the means of transport as compared to other countries have been so muted as to impede seriously the progress of the country towards economic independence. So now we have discussed the progress and problems of road transport. The first one was slow-paced growth. Second was uneven distribution. Third, poor quality. Fourth, small number of vehicles. Five, high cost transport. Now coming to the measures of improvement. To ensure a proper development of road transport system, it is essential to remove its existing deficiencies and expand it on healthy lines. For this, certain measures need to be taken. First is increasing road mileage. The first and the foremost thing to do is to increase the road mileage, improve its quality, and convert a large proportion of unsurfaced roads into surfaced roads. This aim can be achieved only by allocating much larger amounts of resources to it than we have done so far. How necessary is this can be gauged from the fact that at present India spends a very small amount of funds on it. For example, while countries like Australia allocates as much as 2.58% of their national income on highways, the UK and US and Germany earn mark 1.50 to 2.04%, and Thailand 1.44%. India's expenditure on highways amount to less than 1% of national income. The next measure is correcting unevenness. In constructing new roads, the aim should be to lay greater emphasis on evening out wide disparities of various sorts. These imbalances pertain to those between regions, rural and urban, and mountain and plains. This will necessitate that the road mileage should increase at the faster rate than the national rate in areas which are too deficient in respect of the transport. Further, special stress need to be laid on the acceleration of rural roads programs with twofold objectives: extending the mileage and increasing the approach roads, providing links with highways and rail points. Recent emphasis on this is as evident in large allocation of funds, is a right step and needs to be sustained over many years to make any worthwhile impact on the deplorable state of rural transport scene. Next measure is encouraging road transport. Another essential measure is to remove all sorts of hurdles which block the expansion of road transport. Quite many of the government activities in respect of the mode of transport do not facilitate the smooth running of such a vital service. Among them, the principal ones are that need to be revived and changed are the following. First, there is the need to reduce taxes on a variety of its inputs like petrol, diesel, tires, batteries, spare parts, etc., which contribute a lot in raising the cost of operation of this transport. The Kesker Committee 1967 went into this problem and opined that the tax element in the cost of operation had become a definite disincentive to the healthy development of road transport. Secondly, there are the inhibiting influences associated with the administration of transport which must be eliminated. These arise in several forms: dilatory and frustrating process of seeking permits from the authorities, difficulties of transshipments between state in view of the small number of interstate permits to run vehicles, difficulties in respect of crossing check posts like those of Octroi, and further enforcement of various enacts pertaining to civil supplies, sales tax, forests, etc. Thirdly, to facilitate road transport in promoting exports, it has to be adequately expanded in terms of interstate transport. The national permit scheme is the right step in this direction. The number of vehicles under it needs to be expanded and grant of licenses expedited. Lastly, there is an urgent necessity of expanding the production of vehicles, particularly trucks and carry goods and buses for passengers. The next measure is proper demarcation of public and private sectors. While road building is essential a government activity, being long gestating in matters of construction and returns, as also requiring huge investments, production of vehicles and their operations can both be shared by public and private sectors. With the aim of mobilizing maximum possible resources and giving maximum service. For this, a policy giving priority to road transport with areas clearly democratic between public and private sectors, as also facilitates for the arrangements of vehicles, needs to be laid down. This is necessary to emphasize because in the past the policy of nationalization has not met with much success. Of course, nationalization can be eminently justified in this field for various reasons, as public utility service for efficient and economical operations and therefore low costs by avoidance of wasteful competition, for better amenities for passengers, more attractive conditions of services for the personnel, for large revenues from the government, etc. But unfortunately, of such factors as bureaucratization of administration, red tapism, etc., the experience has not been a happy one in case of all the states. Further, in many cases, public transport system has been making losses, burdening the government finances. The wiser course in the circumstances is to go slow with the policy of taking over existing vehicles and routes. Instead, the government should concentrate on augmenting the capacity to produce more vehicles, provide transport facilities in new areas, particularly in villages and backward regions. At the same time, an adequate sphere should be left to private enterprise. Such a policy will also have a healthy effect on public transport. The next measure is rational alignment with other transport. Last but not the least is the need to ensure a rational transport system encompassing all the elements of transport like rail, shipping, port, facilities, etc., in which road transport plays its rightful part. They should also include the transport by bullock cart being the most important traditional mode of mobility. Between road and railways, which together account for a very high proportion of goods and passenger traffic on surface, there is a great need for healthy coordination so that each one separately and both collectively fulfill their economic objectives of promoting development and meeting social obligations. Each one should be assigned the service for which it is better fitted to get the best out of them, and letting road transport as also railways to contribute to the optima of their resources. So now we have completed the discussion of measures of improvement, wherein we discuss the first measure is increasing the road mileage, second is encouraging road transport, third proper demarcation of public and private sectors, fourth rational alignment with other transport. Now coming to the water transport. Though not fully developed, waterways in India are still important and have a large potential. In water transport, marine shipping is very helpful for the economy, particularly for the foreign trade, so crucial for securing foreign resources. In fact, the urgency of making a fuller use of this mode of transport is all the more important because of its superiority over other means of carriage in many vital respects. Superiority and significance. Throughout the world, this mode of transport has acquired a very high placing in the different types of carriage, in particular the cargo, the cheapest. One decisive edge that water transport has over other means of transport is in respect to cost. It is considered to be the cheapest mode of transport. The reasons are not for the sake. First, it involves no cost. Nature provides ready-made routes. Secondly, the addition to these routes through the construction of link channels and their maintenance are not a very expensive affair, because these do not require surfacing, and that these are the assets that are almost permanent and everlasting. Thirdly, because of the large space in ships, these can stomach huge volumes of cargo, making it possible to lower foreign rates. Large capacity and flexibility. Another reason which makes this transport score over others is its large capacity to carry bulky and heavy goods like coal, timber, heavy machines, etc., as also fragile goods like glassware, electric goods, etc., which need smooth movement and delicate handling. It is admitted that at all hands that carrying capacity of the ship is much more than so many wagons of railways geared together, and large number of trucks put to service simultaneously. Put differently, this advantage is to be gauged from the fact that the space per rail wagon as also per truck is much less, and because of this the scope of adjustment within the short space is little. As against this, there is a lot of flexibility in ships to accommodate a variety of cargo. The next is a long distance and large volume. When it comes to the transportation of goods over long distances, as for example for international trade and of carrying large volumes of cargo, which the rising trade among countries involves, there is nothing to beat it. The marine shipping is more amenable to huge trade than either roadways, railways or airways. In fact, there are places where no other medium except waterways are possible or practicable. It is in fact due to shipping that international trade has reached the present stage where goods worth billions and billions in innumerable descriptions and from almost every nook and corner of the world are moving about. It is because of huge ships and carriage of such bulky and low value but much needed goods like food grains, raw materials, etc., has become a reality. As a matter of fact, international trade without water transport cannot even be dreamt of. Special suitability. With large river system and long coastline, this mode of transport is of special importance for India. From the short-term point of view, the low costs are a decisive factor when there are many a claim of on our limited funds, including for the development of roadways, railways and airways. From the long run angle, a country with continental dimensions and many ports needs this transport to support its economy. In view of these considerations, it is essential that we develop this source of transportation to make it adequate and to integrate it with other modes of movement. Next, shipping, growth and problems. So now we discussed about the superiority and significance of water transport. The first point is the water transport is very cheapest. Second, larger capacity and flexibility, and can travel long distances and large carry large volumes, and there is a special suitability. Now coming to the growth and problems. Like many other economic activities, Indian shipping received large stimulus only after independence. Beginning with the first plan, despite its slow, rather non-growth before 1947 and its fast growth since then, shipping on the coastline as also with other countries is faced with many problems. First is slow growth under British rule. During the 100 years of British rule, Indian shippers had to face hostile atmosphere for their expansion. Basically, it stemmed from the anti-national policy of the foreign government, which wished the English shippers alone to profit from it. To this political support may be added the superior economic position of the English and other foreign shippers, which was utilized to offer cutthroat competition in the form of reduced rates and many rebates. As a result, the Indian shipping was almost completely destroyed. Only SC India Steam Navigation Company survived these onslaughts. But as per the agreement of 1924, it was allowed to carry only a meager 75,000 tons of cargo annually. Next, quick increase since 1951. It was after independence that an accelerated growth of Indian shipping took place. The gross registered tonnage, GRT, which was a mere 1.92 lakh on the eve of independence, increased to 3.9 lakhs in 1951. It continued to rise since then. At present, it stands at 68 lakh tonnage, 1998 to 99. Besides the growth of the number of ships and large and their tonnage, a noteworthy feature has been the diversification of the fleet. Provisions of different types of ships like cargo vessels including passengers, cum cargo vessels, bulk carriers including colliers and timber carriers, and tankers helped in catering not only to passengers but more importantly in carrying goods with different transportation characteristics such as bulky goods as iron ore, food grains, etc., liquid goods like petroleum, etc. Expansion of ports and navigational aids. Alongside the growth of fleet, there has taken place a substantial expansion of ports, as also of navigational aids to handle the increasing shipping transport. The country has now the following 10 major ports.